Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show. Edition of Money Matters, show number 247, 247th show. Man, years are flying by. Before we begin, please remember discussions in this show could not be, should not be, and may not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and the opinions of any authors or people I may interview, and they may not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge. This station and staff members are underwriters. 247th edition. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Today's show is entitled March into March Markets. Money matters. It's about money. As money does matter and matters money affect us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. Controls our economy, our country, our planet in some way or another. Controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, it's about you. Yes, money matters is about you. Doesn't matter if you have a lot of money. There's something for everyone on this show. Because we talk about the economy. The local economy, state economy, the national economy and the world economy, it all affects you. What happens up there trickles down to you. You may not think so. A lot of people say, well, I don't have any money. I don't need to listen to the show. You do. Because we talk about the economy. Sometimes we talk about weird stuff like going to Costco, we did, and cooking and investing in your body and your mind. And so there's more to an investment show than just money. Could be investing into a small business. Could be investing into a lemonade stand. Could be investing into your job or your working out or what have you. So, investing is kind of a wide envelope. We can scoop up all sorts of things. I do a lot of stuff investing on yourself. Investing in your mind, investing in your body, investing in your friendships, investing in your community, your job, your education, your spirituality, all these are investing. Investing just means that we We put something in and we get something back. And hopefully we get back more than what we put in. I can probably comfortably say that when we invest in our body by eating well or working out or exercising, we get something back. We get a healthier body. If we invest in our community, and we've talked about that a lot with a variety of programs for the food banks and Salvation Army and what have you, and your local community radio station, you get something back. Investing in your community means the people around you are stronger, and that's what makes the world go around. You know, we can't influence the whole wide globe, obviously, so we try to influence what's around us, starting with yourself, and then your friends and family, and then the people that you know, and then maybe the people you don't know, and the people that you live around, and out it goes, it flows. And the more all of us invest in the community, the better off we all are for it. And a community radio station like KVMR, or all the other community radio stations out that you may be listening to the show on, they all need an investment. They all need the community to come support, not only through listening and participating and coming in and giving their views and opinions, but by participating in whatever support the station may ask for. And we're always encouraging you to support your local community radio stations. You know, they're not really a commercial radio station. Their funds may be limited at times. And so, we ask you to think about that. And so here we are. And we are, again, talking about the markets, at least in the beginning of every show. And we do have another milestone. If you recall, every show I start out with these big milestones. And there are milestones on all different types of indexes, but the largest, the most looked at, let's say, and maybe not necessarily the largest by capitalization, but the most looked at is the Dow 30, otherwise known as the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 30 stocks in there. That's the one that seems to be in the major media news. And we are at 21,051 as I speak, March 2nd, 2017, a little bit after 12 Pacific Standard Time. Now, you may be hearing the show on a rebroadcast, so the indices that I reflect may not be accurate when you hear the show, but those listening live, that's a pretty good indication of where the Dow is. NASDAQ sitting at 5,869, crude oil 52.63 a barrel, S&P sitting at 23.85. What does all that mean? Everybody hears that, and it's, you know, outside of being an advisor or somebody that follows stock, what does all that mean? Well, I can comfortably say that when we see the Dow rise, everybody thinks the stock market is going up. And, you know, there can be times when the Dow might be positive and some of the other indexes may be negative. Just think of each of these indexes like a basket of particular stocks. Not one stock exists in more than, you know, an index. And the Dow is sitting at 21,051. So the big major turning points that I always refer to are the large numbers. 21,000, obviously, is where we are today, a little bit over that. And, of course, I think the last show that I did, we were under 20,000. And people that look at these things as a profession and maybe as a hobby know that these large numbers, 20,000, 19, 18, 17, 16,000, can be viewed as resistance or support levels. In other words, if we are below, let's say below 20,000 in the 19,000s on the Dow, we could say that the 20,000 mark on the Dow is a resistance point. It's a kind of a mental block for all the traders and all the investors that are in the market. Now remember, the stock market, I've always said, reflects the summation of all the opinions of all the investors in it on any particular second. So right now, when you add up the summation of all the investors in it, that is what's making the Dow move. And there's so many things that so many people that participate in this, it's really impossible to tell you which way it's going to go. And so these large numbers, there is a number of investors that look at these large numbers and say, oh, gee, we're at 19,000 something, and it's going to be hard to get through 20,000. So they have a tendency to possibly be careful as we approach 20,000. Well, we blew through 20,000, and now we're 21,000. So we've gone up 1,200, 1,300 points, I think, since the last show. Don't hold me on that, but I think that's what my memory, which is generally failing me, tells me. And so the numbers that you hear during a particular time of day is only the reflection and the perception of all the people that are in this market buying and selling, and the cumulative result is where we sit, whether it's down or up for the day. It doesn't necessarily reflect reality. Now, I will tell you that the markets, in my opinion, will eventually reflect reality. But they don't do that on every particular day. Again, that's my opinion only. For instance, during the crisis when we saw housing started to turn down as far as sales and prices and things of that sort, the housing stocks continued to run. So the reality is the housing market was starting to turn, but the housing stocks were continuing to run a little further because the general perception was that the housing market was healthy, even though it was obviously turning to a very bad place. But the stock market did eventually reflect the reality of where the market had been, even though the market had been running when we initially looked at it. So the day-to-day movements, at least, don't bother me unless we see a huge day and down 50-something today or 60 or whatever it is. My eyes aren't too good. Screen's about 3 feet away. I can't even see that. Go figure that. So if we see a big, large movement, a couple of thousand points, yeah, you know, I'd look at that. But when I see the Dow bouncing around like this, up 50, down 50, and it doesn't really concern me. It really doesn't tell me much. I don't think it would tell really anybody. But you'll see a lot of prognosticators and people that analyze these things try to make something of a daily market. And it's very difficult to do that because, remember, the daily market is really just the perception of all the players in it at that moment in time. And it will reflect reality where the economy goes. You know, I can say that, you know, in my opinion, 30, 40 years ago, the stock market reflected the state of the economy fairly accurately. If the businesses were selling more, then the market would go up and people would perceive the economy as healthy. And then if the business environment started to turn negative, the market would reflect that in a declining balance, whether it be the Dow or some of the other indexes that you look at. But because of the crisis and all the intervention that we saw on the federal level and indeed central banks worldwide, there is more of a belief now that the markets reflect an anticipation of what the Feds or what the central banks of the world will do. So it's may not be necessarily looking at the economy as a whole, but more of what do we expect the Feds to do, which is why we've seen on occasion good news means bad news for the stock market and bad news for the economy means good news for the stock market. The cause and effect of that was something that went something like this. If the market is running and people perceive the economy is getting better, then people would fear that the central banks of the world would raise interest rates to try to cool that down so we don't see inflation. And the increase of interest rates would put a damper on the stock market. So when the Feds kind of indicated, central banks indicated that they were going to raise rates in the future, then all the investors in it, and a lot of those investors that traded large shares would perceive, okay, the Feds are going to raise rates. That's going to turn the market down, so I'm going to sell today, even though the Feds may not have raised interest rates. So the influence of the central banks is indeed, again, in my opinion, more significant than it has been in the past. Some say that's not a good thing, that depending on what the Feds say, they can juice the markets either way. And how does one invest? You could say, well, I think the economy is going to go up, so therefore I'm going to invest in the markets, yet the Feds are going to raise rates and cause the markets to go down, so you really don't know which way to turn. So it is, you know, when we see these, you know, drawing that back to these large numbers, the Dow went blue through 20 and just kept going and then up through 21,000, you know. We had a pretty good move after the union, you know, this, I guess the State of the Union or the, whatever they call that when Trump gave his speech to Congress. And everybody perceived he was going to lift regulations and he was going to spend more on infrastructure. And that's a scene we've seen before. And off the market went. So since he has been, you know, elected, you know, even from November, the market pretty much has run and run and run. And now there's no way to tell whether it's going to keep going, whether the people anticipate he's going to do a good job or a terrible job. Everybody has an opinion on that, of course. So it's very, very difficult to say, you know, which way this thing is going to go. But for now, You know, he's been in there, and we see the Dow run 2,000 or 3,000 points. So the general perception is that he's going to be good for the economy. Will he be good for the economy? I could probably show you 100,000 people say no, and another 100,000 say yes. So, you know, you don't know. When they start pulling levers and pushing buttons and moving gears around up there at the central banks, we never know. I don't think the central banks even know what the end result is going to be in the market. You just don't know what the end result is going to be. And so we do look at these large numbers as an indicator. Okay, we blew through 20,000. We're now in 21,000. Now that we're above 21,000, 21,000 itself is now a support level. So coming up through a big number is called a resistance level. If you're in the 19,000s and you're kind of trying to get through 20, that's resistance. 20,000 is going to possibly provide a resistance point where it's got to punch through a few times. And then when it's above a big number like it is today, it's at 21,036, then there may be traders and investors and people out there that follow these things and analyze these things and prognosticate on these things, that the Dow will have trouble falling below 21,000. And if it does fall below 21,000 and stays below 21,000, then certain analysts would say that that's exhibiting a weakness. So it is hard to tell. You know, I've been asked, a lot of people have said, well, gee, my portfolio, whether they're with Joe Blow over here or J Company over there, they'll say, you know, the Dow's up, you know, to 10% or 5% or whatever it is, and my portfolio's only moved 2. And, you know, part of that reason is, you know, the Dow, a lot of that rally that we saw initially when Trump was running was only because a handful of the stocks in the Dow were moving and they were big. And so they influenced the whole average. Additionally, when the market runs, as we mentioned before in many shows, fixed income may have a tendency to sell off when the markets run. Fixed income, things like bonds and bond funds, those are generally regarded as fixed income. And when the markets run, people, you know, may have a tendency to leap out of fixed income because you're only getting 3, 4, 5, 6 or whatever percent you're going to be getting in that income instrument. And they may say, oh, the markets are going to yield more than that. So they sell out of fixed income and they jump in the stock market. As a result, fixed income can fall. And then when they perceive that the market may be shaky, then they'll say, okay, the market's shaky. Let's go back into fixed income and get a set into interest rate or preferred rate, fixed rate, and then jump out of stocks, and that causes the market to fall. And remember, you know, fixed income, it does move up and down. Not only do, you know, some of the, what we call the coupon rate or the interest rate that some of these fixed income securities yield, let's say if you buy a bond from a certain city, it's yielding 5%. As long as the city continues in its obligations, you'll get the percentage rate that's promised. But the price of the bond itself could fall if one was to sell it early. So all sorts of things that transpire around this. You know, obviously the only way you could invest in an index would be to buy all 30 of the stocks, I guess, but you're still investing in 30 individual stocks. So we're looking at this. We're looking at 21,000. Don't know where this is going to go. We had Trump go out there, gave a speech that many said was less aggressive for the man. More with an olive branch out, but of course half the nation loved it and half the nation didn't. So you could see that during all the applauses, you know, half the hall stood while the other half just sat there. And so obviously by the indication of people standing and sitting when they should be standing and et cetera, or sitting when they perceive they should be sitting when everybody else was standing, I guess it kind of indicated that we still have a lot of divisiveness in the ivory halls, right? I mean, obviously not everybody stood and sat at the same time. So obviously, you know, it was almost right down the middle, wasn't it? That it was very, very divisive, at least in my opinion it was. And so it's rather interesting. Anyway, you are tuned to Money Matters, March into March markets. As we mentioned, the Dow sitting at 21,037. Fixed income after it had its sell-off when Trump was elected. Has recovered some, but they're still bouncing all over the place. And so generally, if your portfolio reflects the market exactly. Market's up 10%, and your portfolio's up 10%. That could mean that if the market goes down 10%, you're down 10%. So normally well-diversified portfolio that holds some fixed income and maybe some CDs or savings and some securities might not necessarily reflect an increase in the Dow. Because really, I mean, if I had a portfolio and the Dow ran 30% and my stock portfolio ran 30%, I'd be thrilled, right? But of course, if the Dow dropped 30%, I wouldn't want to be looking at a 30% loss. That's, you know, that's devastating to a portfolio. So my guess is that most portfolios are not going to move lockstep with the market if they're diversified a lot, because if you're all in stocks and no fixed income and no CDs or savings or cash, you know, then you wouldn't, in my opinion, be diversified. You're all in stocks. And so anyway, everybody's got an opinion. That's mine. You're listening to Money Matters on a community radio station, and we'll take a quick break and come back and talk a little more. SRV, Stevie Ray Vaughan, right here on Money Matters. My name is Mark Cunabrody. Thanks for listening to me today. 12:30, March 2nd, the year of our Lord, 2017. But, of course, the show is carried on a variety of stations all over the place, so you may be listening to rebroadcast. And, of course, if you are, I welcome you there, too. Most of the discussions I have in this show aren't usually applicable. I mean, I've listened to shows all the way back to show number one, and they're still applicable, a lot of those things. Maybe not the prognostications are applicable now, but a lot of the ideas and concepts that when I started this show are very applicable. And, you know, education in money is important. I mean, we have to know how it works. And even though you may not be in the stock market, you should understand at least just minimal grasp of how it works, because it affects you. You know, what happens up there affects us down here. And so even like I said, people say to me, hey, I don't have any money. Why does it show? Well, because what happens in the money markets and the debt markets affects you all the way down here. And so it's very, very important. Anyway, so I have a website, and it's a no-charge website. It's our way of saying thank you for listening to Community Radio Station. And I have social media sites. And what happened was, you know, I have a lot of people that see the site. There's a lot of, quote, you know, 4,000 or 3,800, quote, friends. I got like two friends, really. But, you know, that's all the people that tune in for the show and the articles they log on. So I got a Twitter account, a LinkedIn account, and a Facebook account. I don't do all the other stuff. I got enough to do. So what happened? Trump got elected. You know, sometimes if I post anything that has to do with politics, whether it leans left or right, because so many people see it, the threads underneath start coming. Not only the thumbs up and the thumbs down and the smiley faces and the mad faces, but they start, you know, putting opinions in. Some of them get pretty, you know, I don't know, fiery. And then people start arguing among themselves on my Facebook page. And so it's like, you know, I was watching these threads take off. You know, I post something that maybe lean a little bit one way or the other, and wham, man, they just take off. So it's, I knew, especially since the amount of chatter on these sites, more Facebook than Twitter or LinkedIn, obviously, but the amount of chatter on these sites just went off the charts during this election and after Trump was elected, and it just, you know, the threads were going down on my site, you know, and it was irritating to me to see this. A lot of negativity was being spread and the name calling back and forth between people when I just posted one thing and stayed out of it, and then it just took off. I think that's the downside with having a lot of people that view your site, is that, man, you say something that has got any sort of opinion in it and, man, off it goes, you know. And so I was challenged by a friend, you know. I told him all the, you know, his stuff was making me angry, and I was just getting fed up. So he challenged me to stay off a week of social media, and I ended up staying off a month. When he said a week, because I do radio and I don't want to disappear, people say, did he die? You know, I mean, we got to keep us up with the markets. But he said, stay off for a week. So I stayed off for a week, and my stress level, my internal stress level went down. So I decided to stay off for a month. I stayed off of LinkedIn, and I stayed off of Facebook, and I stayed off of Twitter. I didn't post anything. And I stayed off a whole month and got a lot of emails. I said, where are you? You know? Because you can find my email, you just Google in the name, and you'll find ways of getting into me. I got a lot of different emails because of all the, you know, radio and the media. And I just said I took a hiatus off of social media, and it was such an interesting experience for me. And, you know, I see this level of addiction with my kids on their iPhones. And, you know, I got to admit, you know, I used to text a lot. And, you know, you when you text a lot, you get kind of hooked on it, to the little boing or whatever thing you got set to it. And there's been studies done where it actually activates, you know, hormones in your body when you start to begin to expect it. So the addictive personalities can be addicted to it. And I've got addictive personality. And so I was beginning, you know, if it didn't go off, I'd check it. You know, that's a sure sign of addiction. And so I kind of got off the cell phone kick, you know. Now I text for business only, and I don't banter back and forth with things going back and forth like that. And so I've broken that addiction, and the Facebook thing and the Twitter thing, I broke the addiction to that. I don't get on that anymore. And, you know, and so it was such an interesting experiment. I wrote an article on it, and I started putting it out in newspapers. And I got a lot of response on this article. And so I wanted to read it to you today, maybe give you some food for thought, you know, because I see my kids on the iPhones. I don't let my kids have any social media accounts. They're not allowed to do that. I know I'm kind of a strict parent. What can I say? But I don't. So they get on their phones and they play their games and they text back and forth. And you could see it. I mean, they take their phones when they're laying on the couch and they check and they're doing homework and they say they're listening to music. And then I see their fingers hitting the screen. I say, hey, bud, you know, you are obviously on the machine. And so we restrict them to that, too. But, you know, years ago in 2000, I went to Japan, and I actually took a video because I was in Japan in the year 2000. 2000 and, yeah, 2000. I was walking through, and I saw, I noticed all these people on cell phones. We didn't have all the cell phones, but Japan was loaded. And I had videos of it saying, he's on cell phone, he's on cell phone, look, she's on cell phone. Now, of course, you go to a restaurant, you go anywhere, and people are on cell phones all over the place. I mean, it's amazing that we need to feel, that we need to be on these things, and we need to be there when for the last 5,000 years on this planet, mankind did without. In the last 15 years, you know, 70-80% of the civilized population seems to think they got to steer into these things. And so, you know, it's made things easier for communication, but it's also made things more difficult, you know. I mean, a lot of other things that you might want to put down or not want to look at, you look at, because, you know, I got to check my portfolio is going down. I'll check it again. I'll check it again. I'll check it again. And if it's going up, I'll check it again. And so I penned this article, and I hope you gather something from it. It's investing in yourself. And it kind of goes like this. Social media. 10 years ago, most people wouldn't have known the meaning of the word, right? Today, social media is widespread, well-known, and the number one use of the internet, and probably the number one use of cell phones. You know the sites, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and a host of other websites that people use to post, like, vent, hook up, or do whatever. With billions of folks using these portals, the total combined hours people spend on these things is astronomical and growing. I mean, just do the math. All the people on the planet looking into these screens. Polls run the gamut on how much time folks spend on surfing social media. But recent surveys are beginning to highlight some very alarming statistics. Apparently, not only are people burning away their own time, the cost to businesses are becoming very real. As employees twitter away the hours, pun intended, posting, liking, tweeting, or what have you. A poll put out by Better Works Systems found that 87% of full-time workers surveyed admitted to reading social media during work hours. 87%. About 20% of workers polled admitted to using office computer systems to read more than 20 posts a day, which adds up to, so they say, about 2 hours of paid work time. Approximately 22% of employees idle away 3 or more hours in the la-la land of social media. One could argue the case that social media is decreasing worker productivity, and in a big way. Who knows, really, how many dollars are flying out the window as employees tweet, post, like at the expense of their employers, right? The workers stare into the screens, they're doing Facebook or what have you, and they're not working, and they're getting paid. Furthering the waste, I want you to think about this one. Add up all the hours of posts and profiles and everything else that now exist on media sites, and you could likely say they required trillions of man hours to construct, right? Think of all the profiles that are out there and the pictures and the posting of the pictures and the liking, the comment. You know, that is trillions of man hours that have gone into this thing. I would ask, where are all these lost hours going? Yeah, maybe making millions for the site owners and their advertisers, but it could be argued little else is gained, at least monetarily, by such activity. There is a common belief that there is money to be made by the free advertising to be had by posting to your site or to a social site or putting your profile on there. Let's say if you're a business professional, you put it on LinkedIn. My own personal experience, which is not all-encompassing to everyone's personal experience, obviously, but my own personal experience has, to me, shown little monetary gain to my business. Right? I have two businesses. They're used by many people. But I have seen little monetary gain, at least that I know about, that has come in from social media. And that's despite me having thousands of people, thousands of friends, on the multiple sites that I post to. And my repeated and ongoing posts, profiles, articles, etc. Even radio shows and newscasts. I don't get a lot of people calling. You know, I do get, you know, I don't know, maybe one a month, maybe two a month come in and say, hey, I want to use you or utilize you. But when you think about the fact that I probably post 10 times a month and get 4,000 followers or friends, not followers, friends, and I post on a variety of different public websites that each have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people that subscribe. I put articles out on LinkedIn and also on Twitter. And through all that, if I posted 10 times a day, I might be getting 10,000, 15,000 eyeballs on what I put out. And I post 10 times a month, there's 150,000 eyeballs. And I get like one call, two calls. So I'm sure there are people that have larger accounts than me. I think 5,000 is a limit. I'm up at around 3,900. And I make a concerted, attempt to make sure that I put out on the other sites, the events and all the other ones, when a show's coming on. But despite all that, I get very few calls that come in. I mean, I get a few, but the hit rate out of 150,000 eyeballs, if I get two calls a month, that's a good month. What is that? Two out of 150,000. So is there a monetary gain really by advertising on social media? I haven't seen a tremendous return for that, although it's free. Now, besides the cost to businesses who pay people who are surfing, and besides the cost to your productivity while you're on the phone or you're on the computer surfing, an article by M. Farouk Radwan concludes surfing, social media sites can actually lower self-esteem. You ever think about that? You ever feel that way? It's because people tend to post only positive images of themselves, right? They don't take pictures of them when they're depressed. I'm depressed. I think I'll put this as my profile picture. No, they're pictures of them having fun and they're going to this, cliff diving and parachuting, and they're doing this and that, and this is the restaurant I went to, and these are the people I hung out with, and this is the, the national monument that I hiked up. And what Rod Wan says is when you compare yourself, maybe you're feeling down one day or whatever, and you compare, and you go on social media, and you compare the way you really feel against these fairy tale images, he says that it rarely ends up leaving the viewer with a higher self-image, right? You're not always smiling and joyous and everything. And he claims it can actually lead to battered egos and depression. And he suggests limiting time on these sites. I suppose if you're a happy, super confident person and you don't have any problem looking at other people, smiling and laughing, I suppose then you're not affected. But I think a lot of people may be affected. I am of the opinion, especially after staying off for a month, the majority of stuff on most of these sites, LinkedIn, you can see what somebody does and where they work. And, I do have job offers that come in through LinkedIn, and, they figure out what you do, and then you get related job offers. But my opinion is most of the stuff on the sites can be curious. What's my girlfriend from second grade look like? Right? We all done that one, Whoa. Everybody got old but me. But besides being curiosity, I'm beginning to really believe that a lot of this stuff is useless garbage. I mean, really. It really yields to me really nothing more than wasted hours in hyperspace. After all, who really cares what I ate for dinner last night and where? Right? Who really cares? It's curious to the next guy, but then he blows through it in 2 seconds, he's forgotten. Who cares what mountain I climbed or who I hung out with? And what's the gain in forwarding a picture that strikes my fancy, right? Always a picture of a you know, of a lake. Isn't this pretty? Or posting some enlightening one-liner that I identify with, like, you know, man up and work hard. You know, really. I mean, you want to see nice pictures, go on the web, there's zillions of pictures. So when you post one and you forward it to your friends, it's like, okay, that's a nice lake, but really, what real gain is it? I guess if you posted some enlightening, you know, encouragement or affirmation, that might help, but really is what I've come down to. It's like, really, what's the point? The bottom line is that time spent on social media affects the real bottom dollar line of the people that do it, that go on these sites. And likely, they affect your bottom dollar, probably not in a positive way. This translates to the more time we spend on social media sites, the more money we didn't make doing something constructive or productive for ourselves, our businesses, our employers, our minds, or our bodies, or our community, right? Now, there are some good uses of social media sites. You announce events, and, you know, there's some good stuff there, of course. But really, you know, how many hours do you spend? Maybe, you know, people that listen to this station, I don't get the impression that they're really on a lot of social media, but, you know, that's a pretty broad generalization. But I could still say among the many stations that carry the show, I'm probably talking to, you know, I don't know, 200,000 people that blow some time away on the social media sites. As I said, I took a month-long hiatus from all social media sites as an experiment. It was a dare to release my stress from a friend who counsels me wisely. And I ended up turning it into a month. I can tell you my stress level and the perception of the level of drama and me getting upset over somebody posting against this guy and posting against that guy, it dropped surprisingly. And the extra time I used doing stuff in the real world with real people, and I believe that I am better for it. Many believe, and I believe, the less time spent on these websites, the better. And apparently, the corporate world is beginning to come to the same conclusion. As the real cost to companies become more apparent, I suspect corporate policymakers will begin to put rules and restrictions in place to limit accessibility to such websites. And I can comfortably say you're probably going to see, more stuff come out about how much business is being lost by workers, flittering away the hours. I think that you're going to read more about it. As individuals, you and I, as we begin to, assess our own loss of production, our own loss of time, our own loss of spending time with real people in the real world, out in the sun, or whatever, lately out in the rain, right? And it's because due to the hours spent on such things, when we evaluate how much time we take out of our day to do this, I suspect self-imposed curfews and limits will become more and more prevalent. I really do. And I think in the end, we will all be better for it. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We'll be right back.
I'm working for a living. Hey, I'm not complaining cause I really need to work. But hitting up my buddies got me feeling like a jerk. $100 condo, $200 rent. I get a check on Friday, but it's already spent. Working for a living. Working for a living.
cause I'm working for a living. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
And welcome back to show 247. My name is Mark Cuniberti on your community radio station. This is Money Matters, of course. And finally, as President Donald Trump takes office, one has to wonder what golf course Barack Obama might be twiddling away the hours on and what the heck retirement is like for an ex-president of the United States. Now, this is not to solo out or single out Barack Obama, but fret not, dear listener. Life isn't too bad for those retiring from the highest office in the land. After two full terms in the White House, the American taxpayer will make sure that the Obamas won't have to get any odd jobs to make ends meet anytime soon. And that's for sure, nor have any other past presidents needed to do that. Unlike some pension plans, where you have to be a certain age to start collecting money, Obama will start collecting paychecks immediately. This year, he will collect a hefty sum of about $208,000 and similar amounts for years to come, not counting if he gets any increases, of course. It's interesting, during his presidency, Obama petitioned to cap the total yield value of a tax-advantaged retirement payments before tax advantage was taken away from it at $205,000 a year. He'll be getting $208,000. No goose or gander parallels drawn here, of course. But no worries, there's a lot more where that came from. Ex-presidents get a transition expense for stuff you and I pay for, like phone, stamps, staff, and whatever else they might need to conduct business, whatever that means. The payment can be hefty. George Bush racked up over $900,000 in 1993. They also get office allowances to pay for staff, materials, or whatever else the business might be for the rest of their life. They do have a limit on it. They max out about $375,000 for about 30 months, then it drops to a paltry $96,000 a year for the duration, whatever the duration that might be. Lifetime protection from the Secret Service is included. Before Obama took office, that protection expired after 10 years, but Obama himself extended that for life for Bush himself and all presidents to follow. Estimates on the cost from the Daily Mail. Estimates on the cost for Secret Service protection is about $20 million a year. Ouch. If any of the Obamas get sick, they get the federal health benefit program, which means no Obamacare for the Obamas. Good thing Obamacare may be going away. We don't know what will happen there. They will also get funds to build a library, of course, which happens to all presidents. And the speaking circuit, ooh, what will likely yield millions more in income if history proves to be an example. Not to make you feel bad, of course, nor draw any conclusions about whether ex-presidents deserve this kind of compensation. I am neutral on an opinion on this show. I'm just telling you Obama won't be in the ranks of the middle class. With all this money coming his way and add in all the speaking fees, he will likely be closer to the 1%ers than he will be to the 99%ers he so staunchly defended. Life does have its ironies, doesn't it? We'll be right back to conclude the show. My name's Mark on Money Matters. We'll be right back. And we're running out of time. And as always, check out your community radio station's program guide on their website. And you can see all the fine programming on your community radio station. And we have to always conclude the show with our disclaimer, which means discussions on this show, Money Matters, should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. No, you should not do that. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, who is a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge. This station is staff members or underwriters. This has been show 247 called March into March Markets. I hope you enjoyed it. I have a next show. If I got some time, I wrote a funny script about a news reporter that I saw. A news reporter was doing a newscast, and it was about the flooding that we've seen here in Northern California. And she was doing it next to a generator that was really loud. And I thought, couldn't you have picked a quieter place? So I made up a fictional newscast in my brain and wrote it down. I hope you find it funny if I have time to read it next month or next 2 weeks, whenever I'm on. 2 weeks from today at noon Pacific Standard Time, Money Matters takes the air. Thanks a lot. God bless. Have a great day and go make some money.